The Corbett Report is an independent news source. It's a podcast. James started it in 2007. He's a Canadian based in Japan. The website operates on the principles of what he calls open source intelligence. He does an excellent job of framing and communicating critical issues. When I start to research a new topic, he is one of my go-to people and go-to websites to see, has James covered it? Has he framed it? What does he think is important? So his opinion absolutely counts, and it counts with me. And it's the kind of open source intelligence that can make your life much better because he does such a great job of sleuthing out the real deal based on a wide variety of open sources and is very good at integrating issues. So with that, James, are you with us?
I am, but I must admit I'm blushing too much to even respond. Thank you so much for the kind words.
I don't believe it. Now, before we start and dive in on all the geopolitical and economic stuff, the big news, I think, is 6 weeks ago, you became a father for the first time. Is that not the case?
That is the case. And yeah, absolutely. It's the biggest news in my life, certainly. And maybe not the individual listeners out there, but I think everyone who's had a child can probably relate to what I'm experiencing and going through at this point. And it certainly does put a lot of things into perspective for you when you have a child and are holding it in your arms for the first time.
Yeah, and it inspired you to make a video, which is our video tonight, The Meaning of Life. And if you haven't, just ladies and gentlemen, if you haven't watched it, it is a must-watch. It dovetails completely with the discussion that you've heard from John Rappaport and me when we talked about singularity and some of the other things we'll talk with James about tonight. But I can't recommend it, and there are several comments that are so effusive about how wonderful it is. Like, James, I sent them to you earlier today, and we'll talk about it later, but I think it was inspired by the birth of your son, was it not?
It certainly was, and that event obviously brought forth a lot of different things that I think are the underlying issues of why I'm here doing what I'm doing, and I imagine why most people out there are bothering to listen and to really keep track of all of this that's going on in the world, because it is so easy to get disheartened by the information and just want to sort of give up and roll up in a ball and go in a corner somewhere and just let the would-be rulers of the world do what they will with it. But I think that we have to keep fighting, because obviously there's much more at stake than just our own lives. It's really the future of humanity itself that's at stake here.
Right. You can choose life or death. So the Corbett Report chooses life.
That's exactly right.
Okay, so news from Japan. One of the reasons I was so delighted you could join us was Japan right now, to me, is very much a driver in the global economy. And there are several topics I wanted to talk about. First of all, we've seen dramatic increases since the beginning of the year in Japanese monetary intervention. And, of course, the Japanese stock market flying. It's now correcting, but it's been flying since the beginning of the year. So maybe if you could talk about whether or not Japan is pushing the global money supply.
Well, there's no doubt about that. And for people who don't know basically what's happening here, back in December, there was a new prime minister elected, Shinzo Abe, who's part of the perennial ruling party here in Japan. In the 60 years, I guess, of the post-war period here, there's only been a few years where this party has been out of power, and a couple of those years just came in the last couple of years. So basically, this is the party that's always in power. It's fairly conservative, and even within that spectrum, Abe is a fairly conservative candidate in a number of ways. But part of his platform and part of what got him elected was the so-called Abenomics, this plan to it was a combination of monetary and economic reforms, but basically the monetary side of it was just quantitative easing not to infinity quite as the Federal Reserve has it, but at any rate a doubling of the monetary supply here, the yen, in 2 years, which is pretty drastic. Certainly Japan has been in the doldrums for a couple of decades now, since the popping of the bubble back in 89-90. But they've tried a couple of stimuluses along the ways. They've tried kicking in some money here and there to get inflation going, because they're caught in a deflationary cycle. But it hasn't really worked. They haven't gone all the way with it. They've pulled back every time they've tried it. So the idea here was, well, we'll just commit to doubling the monetary supply in 2 years, and we'll do these economic reforms. Everything will change. And in the 6 months or so since he was elected, we have seen, as you note, that incredible run-up in the Nikkei. We've seen basically a 50% rise since December of last year. And as you say, in the last week or two, there's been a huge correction. In fact, we've already seen it fall about 20% from its highs just a couple of weeks ago. So, and it's continuing to fall. Yeah, it's still up. It's still up. But I think the shine is coming off of Abenomics, which has hitherto been completely 100% about hype and expectation. And that's been being priced into the markets here. But it has been hype so far. And we can see that from the first quarter GDP results. Japan had a 0.9% growth rate in the first quarter, which is pretty good for Japan and considering the economic situation. But when you actually start to peel back the numbers there, what that's actually based on is basically consumer confidence and basically expectations in the markets. But when you look at things like capital investments, they're in fact actually down in the quarter. So there is some serious economic problems here that are not going to be just inflated away. And in fact, we see attendant with this downturn in the Nikkei in the last couple of weeks, we also see the yen is strengthening again. And in fact, just in the past 24 hours or so has taken another big dive. The USD JPY has taken another big dive. So it looks like they might be losing control of this this little wealth effect, as they call it, already. And we've certainly seen in the past few months, regardless of what the Nikkei is doing, regardless of what the yen is doing, we've seen incredible volatility in the Japanese bond market, which is especially worrying because it's the second largest bond market on the planet, and it is absolutely the only thing that's keeping Japan solvent is the fact that for generations, the Japanese people have bought up basically as much bonds as they can as their long-term savings. And now that the volatility is up and people are being encouraged to leave that bond market, and coupled with the demographic winter you have going on in Japan, where basically more and more people are retiring, fewer and fewer people are paying in, fewer and fewer pensions are going to be buying up Japanese bonds, you have the perfect storm for a really cataclysmic collapse here. And I think that could have incredible knock-on effects in the global economy.
One of the questions I have is, if you look at what's happening in interest rates here, I'm wondering to what extent you're watching a little bit of a contagion coming out of the Japanese bond market as this happens.
I would be surprised if there wasn't.
You certainly see here there are lots of steps being taken to protect the financial system from that kind of contagion. We have the SEC coming out soon with regulations that will require or allow, depending on what your perspective is, money markets to mark to market. So you could literally put a dollar into a money market and it's 98 cents the next day. So, that will, one of the near breakdowns last time in 2008 was the money markets and keeping them floating. But you can see they're trying to make the system more resilient. One of the things I wanted to point out, James, was in 1989 when the last sort of bubble burst, we watched the United States mark to market, write down enormous amounts of debt, go through a really gut-wrenching period for both people and institutions, whereas Japan instead, bailed out the banks and sort of kept the debt going and rather than write it down. What's very interesting is the United States this time around is using the Japanese approach. So, now the United States and Japan are much more in sync in terms of increasing the debt and the leverage. And, I wonder at what point the United States is going to catch up with Japan.
Yeah, that's a good question and a worrying one, really, for anyone who knows about the Japanese banking sector and the zombie banks that have been supported by government intervention over the past couple of decades. And they have basically debts that they can't write off. They have loans that they'll never get paid back. And this has just been propped up and kept along by the bailing out of these banks. And it's created a banking sector that is absolutely moribund. And when you have such things as Japanese government bond volatility, that can really affect certain sectors of the banking industry here anyway. And the idea of banks going under in Japan would be, I think, one of the trigger events that could be part of that collapse scenario.
Right, because they're all dependent now on that bond market.
Exactly right. Yeah, they're heavily invested.
Right. Right. Well, let's turn to my other big question. I've said many times in the Solidarity Report, I keep looking for somebody to talk about Fukushima. And there's a very wide spectrum of presentations and opinions. And each time I try and figure out who's telling the truth, I tear my hair out. So I know, in fact, you've been doing a website for several years now on Fukushima. You're in Japan. You follow it closely. Bring us up to date. How is Fukushima? What's the impact on Japan, the Japanese economy, and the wider oceans and ecosystem?
Very good questions. The economic effects, I think we would have to take a look at the energy industry generally here. And obviously, Japan is a heavy energy importer because it's obviously an island nation, very difficult to meet its energy needs. That's why the nuclear industry was not an easy sell here, obviously, for a country that's the only country to ever suffer a nuclear bombing in wartime. I mean, obviously, there's some deep lasting psychological impacts of that on the population. So there's always been, I think, a strong anti-nuclear sentiment here, but that's been overridden over the past several decades by a big propaganda machine campaign, and also, of course, by the greasing of the skids by the companies basically bribing the local municipalities that would take the reactors. And that system has functioned for decades, pretty much unperturbed. Obviously, that collapsed in the wake of Fukushima. So we saw in the several months after Fukushima, we saw reactor after reactor going down for scheduled maintenance and then basically not being brought back online. So there was a period of time last year where, in fact, all of the reactors in the country were off, and it was a nuclear-free country for a very short time. A couple of the reactors got turned on back last summer, and now they're talking about starting up another four later this year. So gradually, it looks like they're probably going to start putting them back online. And there's been some moves towards some lip service about doing some reports and things to talk about nuclear safety. And there's been a formation of a new nuclear regulatory agency, which immediately was called into question because a lot of the board members have accepted either cash payments or other types of services from some of the very industries they're supposed to be regulating. So just more business as usual, unfortunately, in the nuclear industry here. But obviously, this has affected Japan economically. In fact, we've seen Japan with trade deficits, huge trade and growing trade deficits because of the import of LNG and other energy imports that has been necessary to basically keep Japan functioning. So that's had a big economic effect and a political effect as well. As we've seen last summer, there was huge anti-nuclear protests taking place in Tokyo on a weekly basis, drawing out hundreds of thousands or thousands, depending on who you ask. But some of the pictures of those crowds were pretty impressive. And that created at least some lip service from the previous Japanese government about the possibility of going nuclear free. And they, in fact, there was even a panel that recommended to the Japanese cabinet, basically a plan for getting Japan nuclear free by the middle part of the 21st century. That's pretty much been scrapped to the dustbin of history since Abe's been elected, and I think we can see that wasn't worth the paper it was written on. But at any rate, there was that kind of sentiment in the air last year, and perhaps this summer again, perhaps it's kicking off. Just last week, there was another anti-nuclear protest in Tokyo that drew several thousand people, 60,000 by some estimates. So again, we see a big political fallout from this. In terms of environmental impact, obviously, it's very difficult to rely on government or TEPCO sources for information about that because they've been caught knowingly lying about the situation and or covering up information since the very beginning. And just some of the examples of that, for example, there's a system here called SPEEDI, SPEEDI, and I don't remember what that acronym stands for off the top of my head, but basically it's a system for reporting in the wake of any sort of nuclear disaster, reporting what type of fallout there will be and where it's expected to go, given the winds and weather patterns and all of that. And this system was obviously in effect during Fukushima, and it was obviously making predictions. But those that data, even though it's from a government agency and it's publicly funded, that data was actively being withheld by the government for, I believe, 3 months after the disaster. And then they finally released it. And when they did, it showed that, yes, the government knew, and they had the information right after the event took place, that some of the fallout was going to be going right over Tokyo during the first week or two there. So again, there's been scandals scandal after scandal like that with government records eventually coming out showing that they knew more than they were letting on. They covered up data. They hid data. TEPCO was trying to block government investigators from coming to the site, et cetera, et cetera. So all sorts of shenanigans have been played. So I think we have to take anything coming from government or TEPCO sources with a grain of salt. But on the other side, as I think you might be indicating, there's people on the other side who have made some pretty large claims about the effects of Fukushima that might be on the other side of the scale towards the hysteria, and I don't think that that's helpful either. So FukushimaUpdate.com has been my attempt to try to balance some of that and provide some of the latest info about what's really happening there.
I was just up in Vancouver speaking, and after the speech, one of the audience came over. We were all having drinks afterwards, came over and sat down and explained they had just bought land inland and were moving because apparently they were convinced that the stream, the ocean stream coming from Fukushima was headed into Vancouver and the whole coastline was seriously radiated and they had to leave.
Well, there's no doubt the ocean contamination, I think, is the biggest concern overall from this.
Right.
Obviously, direct output into the atmosphere has subsided since the beginning of the event, but the big problem is still the water, which is still leaking out into the ocean, and this comes from a number of sources. Basically, because of the ways that the reactors melted down, and again, that was another example of an unbelievable cover-up where for 3 months they knew that there had been full meltdowns in three of the reactors, and they just didn't tell the public about that for 3 months, as if that's not important information. But basically, the corium, as it's called, the cores of these reactors have melted down, and they are supposedly within the containment, even if just barely, but they don't know exactly where they are, and they can't directly measure that, because obviously you can't get that close to the core to take, you know, samples of exactly where it is and how it's lying, etc. So basically, they just have to make sure that they keep this cooled with water that they're pumping in constantly to keep the reactor cores cooled. Approximately 360 tons of cooling water a day being poured into the reactor vessels. And of that water, obviously, they have to cycle it out and decontaminate it and store the wastewater. And so they have all sorts of storage on site, including some underground pools, which are basically just man-made ponds. They dig out a big pond in the soil, cover it with plastic sheeting, and they store water in there. But some of these underground pools have been found to be leaking, and there's been other leaks that have been confirmed that are basically leaking directly out into the ocean. So contaminated water leaking into the ocean, there's been all sorts of studies that have come out testing some of the waters directly around Fukushima, finding high levels of cesium and other radioactivity in the fish and in the water itself. So this is one of the huge real environmental questions about Fukushima. And because of the ocean currents, if you take a look at the ocean dispersion maps, even by the NOAA and other, you know, official government agencies, they do show quite clearly that the ocean currents definitely do tend towards the west coast of North America. And we've seen the debris starting to wash up last year in Vancouver Island and on the west coast of the U.S. So there's no doubt that Fukushima debris and water and material is washing up and will continue to wash up on the shores of North America. It's a question of what sources can you rely on about accurate reporting about the radioactivity of that water.
Right. One of the, to me, one of the critical issues on the nuclear question in Japan, of course, is the cost of energy for manufacturing, because we're seeing as the economy slows, tremendous competition for leadership in manufacturing. I mentioned the car companies earlier. So auto industry is here the battle between, you know, Toyota and Nissan and General Motors is fierce. So we've just seen the U.S. announce that they're moving a bigger part of their fleet to Asia. And part of that, as you know, is a lot more capital has moved out to Asia. But the U.S. is absolutely committed to being the hegemon in Asia. And given the power and the strength of the Japanese economy, despite all the problems before Fukushima, you know, there's a real issue, particularly if Japan and China ever get together. So maybe if you could talk a little bit about the geopolitics and the dance between China, the U.S., and Japan out in Asia.
Well, that's a very astute observation. That's a very good way of looking at this, because there is a lot of geopolitical calculation going into this mix. And you're exactly right. I mean, the U.S. is turning not just economically, but even militarily towards the Asia-Pacific as something that they're concentrating more and more on, as they, I think, want to move that that sphere of influence more from the Middle East and that sort of crisis region over to the Asia-Pacific. And we've seen that happening in a number of ways in the past couple of years, but part of that, of course, is the economic incentives that are swinging over here, and part of that is the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership Trade Agreement, the biggest trade agreement since the formation of the WTO, that's taking place completely behind closed doors, completely out of the public spotlight, completely without scrutiny, and completely classified under wraps the negotiating text. So all we get is little drips and drabs from leaks that are coming out. Very, very worrying. But you're exactly right. I mean, Japan is a U.S. proxy here in the region. It has been a serviceable U.S. puppet state here for decades, and of course is under the U.S. military umbrella. So there's kind of a symbiotic relationship there, that Japan gets sort of military protection and U.S. gets a foot in the door of the region generally. And I think that we have to understand what's happening here economically in those terms. Interestingly, I think what's happening now with the Abenomics and the attempt to inflate away the yen is disastrous, really, for Japanese industry, because, of course, as the yen weakens, energy costs rise and energy imports obviously rise as well. So that's so the
and
types
that's probably
of,
what's forcing the new nuclear nuclear openings.
Exactly right. I mean, I think that that basically they think that there's no possible alternative here. They have to start producing more energy domestically because they can't afford to continue importing it. So that's definitely part of the calculus there. And so in some ways, I mean, Abenomics in some ways is cutting off its own leg, even as it, you know, puts a prosthetic on the other leg.
I can't fathom that happened, you know. To me, the United States had to have ordered it. I can't fathom that the Japanese would have done it on their own.
Absolutely.
I think the pressure was extraordinary to force them to do it.
Well, there was a very interesting article I came across a while ago, and unfortunately I don't have it in front of me, so I can't reference it directly, but it was talking about how one of the forerunners of what became Abenomics was, in fact, a former Soros associate here in Japan, who was floating the idea about, obviously the Japanese government is starting to lose its ability to basically function. It's under crushing debt levels. They're basically going to have to do something to kickstart the economy, and basically the idea was something like along the lines of Abenomics, and then lo and behold, 6 months later, Abe gets elected, and Abenomics is underway. So that was a very interesting article pointing out some of the parallels there. I have no doubt that this is coming from some higher source anyway. Absolutely. But I think
don't commit suicide voluntarily.
You would think not. But then again, you know, does someone like Abe really consider themselves to be Japanese or more part of the global elite, as they want to be known? Absolutely right. So, but I think another thing to keep in mind with all of this, the cat and mouse that's going on right now, U.S. and Japan and the TPP and how that's shaping up as a weapon against China and attempt to contain China and blah, blah, blah. All of this is I think, going on demonstrably so. But I think we also have to keep in mind the bigger picture, which is that China has been built up absolutely with the 100% knowing cooperation and absolute total involvement of people like Kissinger and Rockefeller, who, of course, paved the way for Nixon to normalize relations back in the 1970s. So we have to see the bigger picture of what's going on here. And I think ultimately all of this playing nations off against each other, etc., is just part of the paving of the way towards the greater kind of global coming together of the nations under the global government.
Now, Trans-Pacific Partnership, I'm sure you've been picking up the dribs and the drabs. What have you been able to piece together?
A lot of the online information about it that's been leaked out has been around the intellectual property side of the agreement. It's supposedly about trade and tariffs and that sort of thing. But in fact, the vast majority of the, I think, 29 chapters, I believe, in the text are not about trades and tariff directly. They're about issues like intellectual property, which touches on such things as generic drugs. drugs, which under the agreement would be basically there'd be all sorts of new stipulations and restrictions that would try to copyright these drugs for longer than they are, and to extend those copyright protections to countries where they don't currently have them, etc. So basically forcing the developing world to help pay the exorbitant costs for big pharma there in the United States. But another huge part of this is basically the lowering of the standards, the lowest common denominator when it comes to digital rights management. Right. And internet, basically copyright protections. So the U.S. has the DMCA, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, which has been really a colossal failure on a lot of levels, and is just really ridiculous in the way that it's implemented. Basically, anyone can lodge a claim on anyone else who they claim is copywriting material that they claim they own, and they don't have to really provide any evidence of any of this, but the person who is the claim is being lodged against is obligated to immediately remove that material, and then to retroactively have to fight against that claim. So it is absolutely just some of the most regressive copyright laws in the world, and now with TPP it looks like they're going to try to extend that same type of protection around to the other trade partners here. And it's important to note this is a pretty huge agreement. It's between, I believe, 10 or 11 countries now. Japan has just recently signed on, and they'll be joining the next round of talks that'll be happening in Kuala Lumpur next month. But of course, again, completely and totally and 100% under wraps. The negotiating text is secret. And the paramilitary protection and security around these events is ridiculous, especially considering that some of the only people who have access to this or any input whatsoever are 600 or so corporate advisors to some of the biggest companies right. that have a stake in this. So it's absolutely blatantly in your face, just 100% corporate lobbying going on behind closed right. doors. But it's just not being even reported on.
It's the centralization of everything by stealth.
Absolutely. I think they've learned their lesson okay. from the anti-globalization movement of the last decade. Basically, as long as they don't put it in the headlines, then people won't even know to protest.
Right. Okay, top trends. Let's talk very quickly about what are the most important trends right now that you're tracking? We want to know what you think is important.
There's too many to possibly limit it down to an issue, but I would say that they're all of a piece. I mean, obviously the economic concerns are huge, and I really do think that we're on the precipice of some pretty big events. I think that I don't believe it's necessarily an overnight collapse scenario, but I think we are being jockeyed into a position where currencies are going to be played off against each other. There's going to be destabilization here, destabilization there. There's going to be competitive advantage and relative advantage here and there, but I think it's moving us towards this idea of replacing the U.S. dollar with a global basket as the world reserve, and moving that into a system that perhaps the special drawing rights administered by the IMF or something along those lines, but definitely into a more internationalist system that will take place probably right. largely behind the scenes, so that the public never really notices that their currencies, which will probably still be individually, you know, locally denominated, will really be controlled centrally. And that, I think that's a process that's taking place, and that's part and parcel right. of the coming cashless society that, again, is gradually being inculcated, where eventually I think everything will be basically determined centrally, and central banks and treasuries will have the ability to turn people's ability to participate in the economy on or off at the flick of a switch. And most people are literally buying into the technologies that will enable this, with the RFIDs and the cashless payments through your Google wallet and all of this.
It's quite extraordinary. It's, you know, if you passed a law saying, oh, you know, everybody has to wear a surveillance device in their glass, you know, there'd be huge objections. But if you simply make it fashionable, it's like, oh, sure, let's do it.
Exactly.
Let's all
right.
carry a surveillance device that can track us. Let's put a video camera in our glasses so they can see everything we're doing. And let's get on Facebook and basically maintain our personnel file for the intelligence agencies, and not only, you know, do we maintain all their files for them, but they make a profit on it.
It is so unbelievable. You do have to laugh. I don't know what is more horrifying, the fact that this is going on or the fact that really it is being implemented exactly as you say, in this way that people literally are choosing to buy into the technology that's doing this. And one of the latest, and I don't want to say greatest, I guess worst examples, is the new Xbox One that's being launched by Microsoft now, where not only is it a camera and a microphone that's always on, there's no way to turn it off, that is potentially, at any rate, always being monitored and dialing back home to its masters in Redmond, but in fact also has a heartbeat sensing device that it can actually sense your heartbeat, so that supposedly so that game designers can work that into their games, and they can make the gameplay
contingent.
Somebody at
Langley can hit a switch and turn it on and spike your heartbeat.
Well, I mean, it's just getting into the stuff that's so far out there, such crazy sci-fi stuff that literally, I mean, Orwell had nothing on this, really, and yet it's become so internalized and so part of just everyday humdrum existence that unfortunately there is a generation growing up now that truly doesn't even understand the concept of privacy,
right,
and doesn't understand why this is
important. They can't fathom, right, they can't. That's why I try and get everybody to read this book, Political Phonerology. They can't fathom a psychopath's point of view.
That's exactly it. And that is the horrifying part. Even if we were in a great system that is being run by people who are basically good and who don't want to do anything bad, why on earth would people concede this much power to a system that at any time could be taken over by psychopaths? I mean, I think it already demonstrably is, but even if we were to give them the benefit of the doubt and say everything's peachy keen now, how on earth could you justify giving power to a system that can so easily be taken over, so easily corrupted, and so easily used for the type of nightmare society that people have been warning about for generations?
One of the things that gives me great hope is if you look at all the different cartels involved in centralization, and I call this the Midianite thing after the story of Gideon in the Bible, what's going to happen is if you look at how much they're all trying to centralize power and competing with each other to centralize essentially digital data, digital rights, internet rights, and at some point I think the war between them is going to kill them all. Is my hope, because you know, it's a lot of evildoers competing for the same data, and at some point they're going to start tearing in. Oh, I think they're tearing into each other now.
Well, so, that's right. I think that there's a tendency for people to think of this as just one single monolithic conspiracy that everyone at the top is on the same page and is working towards the exact same goal. I think definitely there are competing factions, there are competing people, there are slit throats that happen and backstabbings and things that happen in the upper echelons, exactly as there are in the lower echelons. We aren't privy to all of that, but absolutely, I think it is going on.
We do see the bodies falling.
Yeah, exactly. There are times when we see, we see a Strauss-Kahn getting taken down for things that he's been doing for decades and things like this. And you know, I mean, we get to see the fallout, but we're not privy to all the backstage dealings.
Okay, open source intelligence. You know, all of our subscribers, your subscribers, my subscribers, everybody's busy. How do people build and maintain good maps of our world? What are some of your tips on how do we manage uncertainty? How do we find great sources? How do we stay on top of news stories and trends and what's important without going crazy or getting too depressed?
Well, I can certainly sympathize with the crazy and depressing nature of a lot of this information, but I really wish I had a panacea or something that I could give people that would be a shortcut to amassing good information, but I just don't think that there exists a shortcut to that. I think that if you don't put the effort in, you'll never be able to arrive at constructing that map that you were talking about earlier. And I think we all are desperately in need of a good map to see our way through this, because even if we know where we want to arrive and we know basically what that looks like, how on earth are we ever going to get there if we don't have a map of the terrain around us? So constructing that map is the number one priority, I think, for anyone who's serious about preparing themselves for what's coming. And the question is, how do you start doing that? And really, I think that there just, unfortunately, there's no shortcut to the intellectual rigor that's necessary to really form an accurate map of what's going on. And you raise the concept of open source intelligence. This is something that basically, as I was putting the Corbett Report together back in early 2007, I came across several articles that were being put out at that time about the concept of open source intelligence. And basically, you have CIA officials and others saying that the vast majority of the information that they deal with, 90%+ of it, isn't from James Bond, you know, spying and stealing and taking photographs of behind enemy lines or anything of that sort. It's from completely 100% publicly available sources. And
that's amazing what's available publicly.
It really is. It really is. And in fact, recently, just in the past few months, I remember reading that there's been a manual leaked online. It was like a CIA or in some sort of intelligence agency manual about how to use Google basically to do spying for you. So they're just with simple search commands, as long as you know some of the commands, you can look for open databases and lists of passwords and things like this just through using Google. So again, of course, Google is intimately embedded within the intelligence apparatus, so I think that should come as no surprise. But at any rate, absolutely, there's so much information that is publicly available, and so much more of it is easily and instantly accessible to the general public now than it ever has been at any other time in human history. I mean, the sheer amount of data that is available at our fingertips is absolutely staggering to think about and basically impossible to really put into a proper perspective. And of course, that creates the opposite problem to what's existed throughout most of human history, which has been a paucity of information. Now we have just an absolute overload, a torrent of information. So the question isn't necessarily how to get information, it's how to source accurate information, how to verify information. And that is, again, that's something that's so difficult to do, and it's not something that I think, I mean, you talk about eliminating or at least reducing uncertainty. I think to a certain extent we have to be more savvy in our understanding of uncertainty and more open to the possibility that there is a certain amount of uncertainty out there that we're probably not going to be able to ultimately decide, at least not in the short term. So sometimes it means dealing with that uncertainty and basically hedging against what you think are the likely alternatives. Again, this is all very general, but basically what I tried to do with my podcast is put them together in a way that hopefully demonstrates how I deal with some of this uncertainty, how I source some of my information, how I connect some of the dots, how to read between the lines of some of the articles, because I think a lot of information does come from even mainstream sources. It's just what they choose not to tell you, or, you know, the way that they tell you often is the spin on the story. So there's a lot of art and finesse to it, and I don't claim to be a master at it, but hopefully just my experience of going through and creating these podcasts will help people to get at least a feel for how this can be done.
Well, I would say it this way. The mainstream media often has the data right, but they have the framework wrong or invisible. And so what I find is every time I can find someone like the Corbett Report or a source like the Corbett Report that is really good at going out and sussing out a good framework on something, it's a real force multiplier. Because if you can get a network of 10 or 20 sources that are doing that, you know, then you can really start to pick up speed. Your learning metabolism as a network can increase. So I think one of the keys to this is being good at creating frameworks because it allows you to differentiate between the noise and what's really important. And I think collaboration. No one is as smart as all of us. And we have to be open and we have to be collaborative, because if we're going to, you know, the group that is managing governance on this planet is thinking and acting ecosystem-wide. So we can't stay in our little niches. We need to be able to think and act ecosystem-wide. And that requires a lot of collaboration and a lot of dependency on other people. So every time you can find somebody who can provide strong frameworks on something, to me, big force multiplier. So bottom line, give us some recommendations as to what your top sources are.
Again, it's difficult to say. I can tell you some of the websites I visit and some of the places that I go. I mean, for example, for economic information, I think Zero Hedge is valuable. But then on the other side of that coin, I think sites like MarketWatch and Bloomberg are, again, valuable sources of data, certainly right. spun data, but data nonetheless. For news and information, I often turn to sites like Blacklisted News, Global Research, BoilingFrogsPost.com, Asia Times Online, XSKF is a website of economic and Fukushima-related information here in Japan. Asia Pacific Perspective, all sorts of different sites out there. But I think part of the art to it, I suppose, if there is an art, is to have lots and lots and lots of sources and to be able to source through the information that's coming out on basically a daily basis, which does really it takes a certain amount of organization to be able to do that. And there are little tools and things that I think a lot of people don't know about or don't use to their full potential that are available for even in your web browser, for example, to really help out with something right. like that. So again, it depends on your browser setup and everything, but there are things called RSS feeds, which basically if you use them, for example, in live bookmarks in Firefox or Safari or somewhere like that, you can take a look at all of the headlines coming out of one of those websites at a glance. You can see all of their latest headlines. And so basically every day I'll start by just going through the headlines that are coming out of my top 10 or 20 websites. And then sourcing, basically drilling down, seeing which stories I want to take a look at. I'll take a look at them. If there's something interesting in them, I'll save it physically to my hard drive, which I think is important because a lot of people think that, well, it's on the internet, I can go back to it if I need to, but I don't think we should ever take that for granted because there's been a lot of right. stories that come out very interesting and immediately get scrubbed or eventually get taken down. So it's very important that people think about that and start saving things to their own hard drive. And then hopefully you'll be able to basically start up an archive of stories on various subjects. I have them sorted out by country. I have or sorted out by topic, like the economics, geopolitics, globalization, things like that. And so I have this archive now of 7 or 8 years of articles and stories that I think are important. So it's pretty massive, but at any rate, I can at least search by a keyword or by name or date or something along those lines to try to, you know, drill down on a subject when I need to know more about it. And it's really it is a long, slow, and difficult process of putting together one piece of the puzzle at a time. And it's a trillion piece jigsaw puzzle. So you're never going to be able to see the entire picture exactly as it is, but you can start constructing little pieces of the picture and put those pieces together with other pieces and start getting a handle on the bigger picture. So it's a very long, very slow process, but with perseverance and a bit of organization, you can make a significant headway on it.
A few quick questions from subscribers. Given that each person only has a limited amount of time and energy, do you have a guiding philosophy to determine how much time to devote to matrix-like activities, such as trying to decipher complicated tax laws, and how much time to devote to what one might consider to be more meaningful endeavors? Good question.
That is a good question, and I think probably a major question for a lot of people out there, including myself. And I wish there was some kind of, you know, philosophy I could give behind this, but honestly, I would say that my research interests and what I choose to spend my time looking at is largely driven by my own preference. I mean, I am driven by my own intellectual curiosity. That's basically what drove me to really start the website. I mean, aside from getting the information out to other people, which is definitely, I mean, obviously an important part of it, but basically at base, the website is an excuse for me to have an excuse to be doing this research constantly. And that's basically what I want to do. So if it's not coming from a place of genuine curiosity and genuine excitement to learn more about a subject and to figure out more about it, then you're probably not going to be as interested in finding those answers. So if it is just a laborious chore to be looking at a certain subject, I would say, well, maybe you should start looking into a different area. And I do allow my intellectual curiosity to lead me to a large extent, which might mean it's a somewhat scattershot approach. But again, I think just time after time after time coming back and circling around through various variations on different topics and different themes, eventually you start to build a bigger and bigger picture, and then you can cycle around and touch on some of the same themes again. And the more often you do that and you go around that cycle and you start to basically flesh that picture out piece by piece. And that's generally the approach I've taken, and I think it's worked for me. I understand that could be frustrating for other people, but for my own taste, that's definitely worked in my experience.
The one thing I would say, I'm a money manager day to day, and so I'm very focused on the markets, and there is a remarkable process of the government, you know, sort of the leadership running trial balloons. They always like to say, well, we told you so, you know, so they will quietly put something out and tell you what they're going to do. And, of course, when you understand what they're saying, it has momentous implications for the markets. And so they'll run these trial balloons, and then oftentimes after it's over, they'll go back and say, see, you know, here's what we told you. And oftentimes it's in fiction. They'll kind of crow about what happened one way or another. And so I do find myself spending a surprising amount of time watching The Matrix, because I'm looking for those trial balloons that are very useful in terms of predicting where money is going to shift.
100% agree. That is such an important point, because you really have to track the trajectory of the propaganda to see not just where the story is, but where it's going. And I think that's not just in markets. Obviously, that's exceptionally helpful in the markets, but in every field of study. And for example, I mean, something that's happening right now, there is a definite marked cultural shift that's going on in the nature and the tone of the narrative of the conversation about subjects that have, up until this point, being completely taboo in the mainstream, talking about such things as false flag terrorism, talking about things like Bilderberg. The conversation is changing on that in the mainstream little by little. And I think we can start to see, for example, as you mentioned in the beginning of today's show, you were talking about Bilderberg and how basically they're trying to control the media by giving little bits and press releases and things now, and they have an official website. Exactly right. So we can see this, and for anyone who's been watching something like Bilderberg for several years now, you've gone from seeing it being completely 100% off the mainstream radar. In fact, it was a conspiracy theory to even talk of its existence, and we're now seeing that shifting into, well, of course it exists, but they're not talking about anything important. So again, I think that was pretty predictable from what we've seen over the past few years, the way that the anti-Bilderberg movement has been building up. And I think the next stage of this is obviously, if we are interested in exposing what's happening and spreading this awareness to other people, we have to be ahead of that trajectory, and we have to be confronting that before they even present that argument, that it's just a harmless little talking shop. So the more prepared you are for where that propaganda is going, the more you can head it off at the pass, and you can counter those types of objections before they're even raised. And I think that's a very important part of the whole process as well.
Okay, last but not least, let's go back to the meaning of life. One of the drumbeats we've kept hitting on all year long in the Salieri Report is beware in the media the denigration of human intelligence, denigration of human possibility, denigration of our ability to take responsibility, come together, do things, you know, on and on and on. We did a Salieri Report on the singularity philosophy and, you know, beware this idea that humans are really a machine and we can integrate with machines. And John Rappaport and I spent a Salieri Report talking about Kurzweil and Singularity Is Here. And one of the reasons I love your video is you just do a wonderful job of framing, on one hand, this incredible denigration that goes on, and then you frame it up against the Mr. Rogers presentation, which is, you know, talk about a man who celebrated life and helped everybody realize their potential, and it was really for people realizing their potential. But maybe if you could just talk a little bit about how you see these issues and why they're important to you.
Absolutely. Well, I know that you spend some time here on the report talking about Hollywood and cultural programming, because it is so important. We can learn so much about not just what's happening in the world, but even just society itself and the way it sees itself through the types of cultural programming that we're being fed. And it's difficult to even pinpoint or to lock this down to just one or two examples, but it is such an overwhelming message that's being spread through so many different cultural venues these days, that humans are a cancer, humans are basically a parasite on the planet, humans are just something that needs to be eradicated because all we're doing is messing the planet up, the world would be so much better without humanity. This message is being promulgated right now in so many different cultural venues, and it's especially insidious, because everyone who puts these ideas forwards always think they're being so countercultural, so edgy when they put this forward. Oh yeah, humans are just a cancer, we should get rid of them. And they, I think people really don't understand how much they have been programmed to have that viewpoint, and to see it as the alternative viewpoint, and ooh, I'm so edgy for thinking this, when it really it's just a product of mass cultural conditioning that the culture has been undergoing for decades now, and it's really accelerating. So you can see this in a lot of different areas and venues. And for example, I have on my own podcast a series called Film Literature in the New World Order, where we look at some of the cultural programming. And we looked, for example, recently at Soylent Green and the 1970s overpopulation scare. Yeah. So I mean, we see this, how this has been threaded into the cultural narrative for decades. But it's really coming to a head with this type of ultimate denigration of humanity. And basically, the scariest part for me is that when I started researching into this, I couldn't believe that people could be made to desire their own death, made to desire their own enslavement. And unfortunately, that's really what the ultimate roots of the ultimate end goal of this type of philosophy is. This singularity, the transhumanism, the eugenics, all of this really is about just trying to get people.
You're trying to make slavery and genocide fashionable.
Exactly right.
And once you can make it fashionable in the consciousness, then you can really implement it on a much wider scale.
And the scariest thing is that it is working as well as it is. I mean, it is, again, it's just overwhelming to really think of it from that perspective. But there are people out there that genuinely do think that if not they themselves personally, at least a lot of people around them need to die to make space on this planet and all of this type of rhetoric. And of course, this is completely counteracted by the facts. I mean, even the UN predicts, of course, the global population will start contracting after reaching 9 billion. So this idea that it's just going to spiral on forever and population is going to continue to increase is not even scientifically valid, let alone all of the implications about how the Malthusians and the people of that bent have been wrong about their predictions every single time for the past two and a half centuries, right? Almost. And always they fail to take into account technological developments, etc. But even disregarding all of that, I mean, it is really disturbing to see the way people can really be made to desire their own death. And so I think we have to understand that this is culturally conditioned, and we have to really break out of that conditioning. And how we do that is obviously too big a question for any one person to handle. But I think, for example, that Mr. Rogers presentation that I put in there is the perfect counterpoint to the type of death, violence, glorification culture that we've been steeped in for decades. Because at least for myself, and hopefully for some people out there in the audience, the counterpoint between that and what we're being conditioned with, what Mr. Rogers is saying, that television should be about glorifying life and making people understand what a beautiful gift life is on this planet, and contrasting that with the humans are a cancer type rhetoric. It's kind of a slap in the face. I mean, it's pretty overwhelming, and I've had a lot of feedback from people who say, I mean, it was uncomfortable to watch that, or I cried after watching that, and it really is just so, because we have been, I mean, it's so basic part of the programming of, I think, any being on the planet. I mean, just basic survival instincts are the...
Right, when you go out and wander around and pay attention to the media, it's almost like you need to put up a psychic umbrella from the acid rain.
That's it, yeah. I mean, it really does start to erode at our soul, at our most the core of our being is being chipped away at day by day, and you don't really realize it until you see someone who's making an effort to really go against it. So of course there are people who react violently against this type of message, and they think that I'm crazy for even daring to posit the idea that humans could be a good thing.
Oh no, you're not crazy whatsoever.
Well, yeah, I know that, but I think some of the people out there are just so steeped in this conditioning that it's hard for them to break out. So that was my own humble attempt to try to, you know, add something to the other side of that balance.
Okay, well, very, very quickly, thank you so much for joining us on the Slayer Report. Give us just a few minute tour of the Corbett Report, your website, your other websites, how we can find you, how we can follow you, how we can support you.
Well, basically, the best way to find me and all of my work is CorbettReport.com. That's C-O-R-B-E-T-T report.com. And there you can find my podcasts, my interviews, my articles, my videos, basically thousands of hours of media that I've created over the past 7 years, 6 years, and all available completely free for download. So I hope people will take the opportunity to explore the archives and basically use them as a resource, which is what I hope that they really are at the end of the day. I also have FukushimaUpdate.com, as I mentioned. That's being updated several times a week about the latest information coming out of Fukushima. Other than that, I'm affiliated with a number of websites now. I'm honored to be affiliated with, for example, as you mentioned, Sybille Edmonds, FBI whistleblower, at BoilingFrogsPost.com. She's just an incredible, incredible person who has really sacrificed basically everything to not only blow the whistle, but to continue to shine a spotlight on some very important
things. Talk about a great whistleblower.
Absolutely.
There she is.
She's the real deal. So I hope people will check out BoilingFrogsPost.com. I do a video report for them once a week, and that's available there. I also do the editorial for the International Forecaster. That comes out Wednesdays and Friday, Saturdays, and I do an editorial there, usually on matters economic and financial, but also on political and social issues as well. And again, that comes out twice a week. And I also contribute video reports to globalresearch.ca, the Center for Research on Globalization in Canada. And I'm also affiliated with a site called tragedyandhope.com, which is a bunch of independent commercial-free media producers who are working towards trying to educate people on these types of matters. So I have a lot of different affiliations, but again, CorbettReport.com is the one-stop shop for basically all my work.
And when exactly is it that you sleep?
Well, now that we have the screaming bundle of joy, there ain't a lot of time for sleeping, I'm afraid. But I'll sleep when I'm dead. It's okay.
Well, James, it's been a pleasure to have you on the Salyer Report. Thank you very much, and we wish you all the best.
Thank you so much. Good to talk to you.